So step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, is A's way of stating the best possible attitude, state of mind, one can take in order to make a beginning on this lifetime job. So when they talk about an attitude of gratitude and acceptance, well, isn't this what it is? A few of them may be, but with most of them, we shall have to be content with patient improvement. That's why they have step 10. So we can pause, realize we need to be patiently improve ourselves one more time. The key words are entirely ready, underlying the fact that we want to aim at the very best we know or we can learn. How many of us have this degree of readiness? It says the best we can do with all the honesty that we can summon is to try to have it. Well, I don't know how you try, but I've learned how to try with the steps, and that is to practice the daily to try to have it. No matter how far we have progressed, desires will always be found which oppose the grace of God. It's an old idea and challenge with the new idea that we talked about earlier. And then they go on about what some of these things would be: pride, greed, lust, gluttony, envy, sloth, all the defects that we talked about earlier. The redundancy is extraordinary in the book. After all, hasn't it been self-interest pure and simple that has enabled most of us to escape? Not much spiritual effort is involved in avoiding excesses, which will bring us punishment anyway. But when we face up to those less violent aspects of the very same defects, then where do we stand? They're really saying, you know the blatant things, but let's look at the day-to-day living here. Let's look at the less violent aspects of what you must stop doing right now today, that you have the power to stop, this moment, this thought, this less violent aspect, this little nature that's wrong with you. So it's no longer important what you do wrong. It's the nature of the wrong, the nature of what causes it. What are you really like? What is your character? Do you know who you are? And then they give you examples of that, where greed's mask is as ambition. All the things that usually happen to sober people. It's no longer greed when you're sober, it's ambition. And they say that gossip barbed with our anger, a polite form of murder by character assassination. Whew, imagine. It's really something. And then we talk, instead of gluttony, we just say, well, we're taking our comfort. And then it tells you that from this defect we must get a warped definition of yet definite satisfaction. Else why would we consume such great amounts of time? This is incredible now. Great amounts of time wishing for what we have not rather than working for it. Or angrily looking for attributes we shall never have instead of adjusting to the fact and accepting it. Very hard to do. Very hard to do. It requires a level of honesty that is just almost sometimes beyond me. But the greatest honesty is knowing that you have to go there and that you're there. Nearly anyone would submit a good list of defects as these, and few of us would seriously think of giving them up, at least until they cause excessive misery or darken your spirit. If you're sober a while, you're not addressing these issues, they will darken your spirit. They will cause excessive misery. You will do something about it. You will do something about it. And it's the soul sickness that they referred to earlier. And then they ask you to go ahead and work a little further and still find the still milder list of defects, the little things, the day-to-day shoelaces. So the difference between the boys and the men is the difference between striving for a self-determined objective and the perfect objective, which is God, which requires you to do nothing more than accept where you are at this exact moment, no matter what is going on in your life, anyone else's life that you know, anyone that you love, don't love, or whatever is going on in your family, your life, your world, your profession, anything, your money, your property, your prestige, your kids, your whatever you've got, goats, chickens, fish, doesn't make any difference. Many of us ask, how can we accept the entire implication of sex six? Why, that is perfection. Sounds like a hard question, but practically speaking, it isn't. Only step one, for we made 100% admission, we are powerless over alcohol, can be practiced with absolute perfection. You have all done that absolutely perfectly. Their remaining 11 steps state perfect ideals. They are goals toward which we look and the measuring sticks by which we estimate our progress. Seen in this light, step 6 is still difficult, but it is not impossible. And besides, you know, after you're sober long enough, you know what the deal is with God. My job is to use my will to do what is possible. And my God's job is to use its will, our will, to do what's impossible. So I now know that in that combination, I can absolutely do what's impossible. There is nothing impossible. Why would I limit myself with an impossible thought? That's why if you told me there were little blue and green men with 16 eyes living on Mars, I would say, hey, it's possible. Until I know differently, it's not, everything's possible. It broadened and expanded my whole entire universe, world. If we could gain any real advantage in this use of this step on problems, and here it is, other than alcohol, if we could gain any real advantage in the use of this step on problems other than alcohol, we shall need to make a brand new venture, a new idea, into open-mindedness, no judgment in the world of open-mindedness. We shall need to raise our eyes toward perfection and be ready to walk in that direction. The only thing that will halt you from walking in that direction is judgment, was my experience. It will seldom matter how haltingly we walk. The only question is, are we ready? Let's dispose of what appears to be a hazardous open end we have left. It is suggested that we ought to become entirely willing to aim toward perfection. At the very least, we shall have to come to grips with some of our worst character defects and take action toward their removal as quickly as we can. The moment we say no, never. By the way, no, never is a result. My experience in life is the minute I have a result, it's limiting. My answers belong with God. That's why I've begun the practice of living in the question and doing step, you know, part of my encompassing step 11 during the day, 10 at night, 11, really kind of just semantics. The knowledge of God's will of what and why and how to do all those things so that I can avoid saying no, never. Never going to come back and do another step practice ever. Here I am, same place, same time, a couple of years later. This delay is dangerous and rebellion may be fatal. It is at the exact point at which we abandon our limited objectives, and move towards God's will for us. Anytime I have a problem with that, I say the serenity prayer. So in 6, I have come to accept any old idea, any character, and anything I know about myself, I accept solely in 6. I go on to substitute the bigger problems that I've had for milder problems, less violent aspects of my character, milder little problems, until I can even accept those little idiosyncrasies about myself that seem so unimportant. But you know, after a few years, you're just left with that little stuff. Find out it was more important than the big stuff anyway. Step 7, humbly ask and remove our shortcomings. The second I accept myself in 6, the second, that minute, within less than a second, if such a thing is possible, less than a second, step 7 is working. I mean, the big book is 2 paragraphs, so read 1, bam, it's working. It's exactly how I have found in my experience that it works in life. This is what I must accept. Parents, can't do anything about the death of my relatives in Ireland. Can't do anything about it. Can't do, powerless. And there's part of me that absolutely casts a shadow on my own peaceful light by my effort to try to figure out what I can do. And I know I can't do anything. But that doesn't mean that I'm not struggling to try. And I have to accept, I cannot do anything. And until I stop figuring out what to do, I haven't accepted that I can't do anything. And then suddenly I just get it every now and then that I can't do anything. And I pause. And I say, you know, what would you like me to do? Is there anything I can do? Or how can I be of service in a way that isn't going to create a result? What can I do to give me more peace and perhaps my sister? The second that happens, a peace
comes over me that I cannot describe to you. Because I have asked for help. I have humbly asked God to remove that shortcoming. And it is instantaneous. And it happens by my acceptance of the fact that I can't do anything. But ask God, what do you want me to do? When do I do it? How do I do it? Do I call? Do I not call? Do I go over? Do I call the doctor? Do I not call the doctor? How do you know if she's breathing? Don't you think I need to know? Anything that worries me. Take all those worries. Got to get rid of them all. And until they're all gone, I haven't accepted the situation. When they're all gone, I accept that situation, and then I know it's going to be okay. I don't know. It's just a feeling. Since this step so specifically concerns itself with humility, we should pause here to consider what humility is and what the practice of it means to us. Indeed, the attainment of greater humility is the foundation principle of each of AA steps. When I realized that humility was the ability to ask, that's it. Just ask. The minute I say, help me, this is as humble as I'm ever going to be. I'm Irish. It takes a lot to say, help me. Indeed, the attainment of greater humility is the foundation of every AA step. Every step requires your participation and your willpower. The only free ride you got was on the perfect half of the first step. God did for you what you could not do for yourself, but drunk you were praying. The rest of it is your will in conjunction with God's will to get you to this point where you will want humility to be a way of life. You know, if AA was for people who needed it, we wouldn't be able to get in the rooms. And if the spiritual way of life was for people who needed it, why be the same problem? But it's not. It's for people who want it. And when humility becomes a way of life that you want, it will end up being a way of life that you come to need. It will be a greater addictive power than booze. If you step in and start to drink from the glass of humility, this word we are not supposed to discuss because if you mention the word humility, well, you're not humble. What kind of bullshit is that? How are we ever going to find out about these things if we don't talk to each other about them? Bill Wilson's dead. He's not a right to run the next version of this thing. There's no next book. This is it. Me, you, sharing with each other. I'm here to tell you. This humility thing is so big, you can get addicted to it. You have to be careful. Keep this thing in balance. I don't know what it would be like not to have those moments where I get to that part where I'm powerless. I ask to get restored. I make the decision to get the help. I say, wow, you know, it's back. That fear is back. Okay, this is how I've kind of reacted to it this time. It's always new and different and exciting and creative. And, you know, the new idea is now help me to feel that I am protected. And not alone. Help me feel that I'll get through this too, even if she dies. Help me to feel that. Been there before. Had a brother die from this disease. Hey, pain does not stay. Don't remember what it feels like. Well, just recently in March, it's his anniversary of his death, I thought. Well, died on March 17th. Hell of an Irishman to die on March 17th. And I just felt this year, you know, I don't feel this connection anymore. Wow, wonder what that means, you know. I used to really get comfort from thinking, you know, that at any time, you know, my grandmother, Jane's grandmothers, they're always there, you know, around the house. And I feel that, you know, kind of grew up with it. My mother used to hear a knock on the door, and she would say, answer the door and let them in. That old Irish thing, you know. So I kind of knew about it, and I was worried, and I said to Jane in March, you know, something doesn't feel right with my brother. You know, it's the anniversary of his death, and, you know, for all those years, I've been sending the flowers, you know. Actually, I thought about not sending them this year. I thought, what the hell, you know, my mother's moved now. Why the hell should I send the flowers? I'll wait till my mother dies. I mean, this is the kind of mind, you know, and I wonder why I spiritually got off the track here. Well, you know, she's not going to go see the flowers. I mean, really, nobody's going to see the flowers. I mean, why don't they, like, do this thing? And then my mother will die. Okay, then I'll send the flowers because, you know, it's your mother. And but in the meantime, I've sent those flowers for years, you know. And I always sent them for my mother anyway. And, well, nobody's going to know I didn't send the flowers. Can you imagine? And then I wonder why I feel like the guy's spirit is no longer, like, available to me. And I don't know where we were or what happened. And I said, oh, Jean, you know, I don't know, something, I don't know. Maybe I got to learn more. And I just thought that there was a place people went. And, you know, I just don't feel it. And we came, I had a busy morning. That morning, being of service to a whole other thing, which is a take this time off in my life to do nothing, to find out what I would love to do. I don't have a clue what I'd love to do, you know. But I want to do something. And, you know, I figure I'll find out eventually. Something I would love to do. So while I'm trying to find out what I'd love to do, somehow the spiritual universe has me doing all this service stuff. It's really, I think, yeah, not just enough. But anyway, I became on the board of this condominium complex that we live in. And, you know, of course, my experience, I can be of great service to them in getting it organized and have been able to do all that. And, you know, because I ran a business and it's easy and it's fun. And it kind of reactivated my mind and I thought, Jesus, I really don't love doing this, but it works. Now, I'm packing my briefcase, you know, because, I mean, I've taken this on as a challenge. I mean, I'm just a volunteer, for Christ's sake. And I show up at these meetings with the big, huge briefcase, folders, clicks, things. I mean, you can tell that I haven't been doing anything for years. And you know, I come in like, you know, everything's printed, run off, computerized, you know. I can't type or anything, but I get it all typed, and I do all the stuff, you know. And then I say to this little fellow volunteer, listen, you know, had a secretary my whole life, can proof a thing of my life depending on, would you mind proofing this and do this? I mean, I got them all working for me. I'm trying to remain humble through this whole experience, too, by the way. It has been the greatest challenge to my my effort to work the steps, because one thing to do it in your life when you've got nothing to do and you're hanging out, but try doing it when they give you a job and a project. And, you know, you're a, you know, ex-workaholic. Doesn't know, no neutral in this body. You know, either stop or go. I don't have a neutral. Still don't have a neutral. Know that about myself. Accept it regularly. So here I am down there with the briefcase and all this stuff, and I'm on time, and these meetings are on time, and things are happening, and sign the goddamn paper, and who needs all these people anyway, for Christ's sake? Goddamn place is in a mess because it's a democracy. We don't need a democracy. Look, I'll sign it. One hand washes the other. You give me your signature, I'll give me your, and we're voting this shit through. It's unbelievable. And I come home every night, you know, and write all this stuff out. Oh, man, I better get the answer for this tomorrow, because if not, I'm going to, like, take action. So that's what's been going on in my life when I'm trying to figure out what I'd love to do, you know. My friends say to me, gee, have you drawn anything lately, or painted, or, you know, things people who, like, take this, expand the periods of time to do nothing to find out what they'd love to do. Have you done any of that stuff? Oh, hell no, I've been too busy running everybody's life. You know, you got a business in trouble? Hey, call me. I'll come. I'll be there. Sure, I can tell you everything. Become a guru to all these people. And anyway, bottom line is, I'm busy. Right? And I'm at the kitchen table being really busy. And when I was standing on this big table that we have, I know I was standing there. It's really important, the spot I was standing on. And Charles, you know the spot well, where I sit on my end of the table. And I had the can. I'm loading this stuff up there, you know, which means, if you know me at all, that I was there for a while. Because believe me, when I go to those meetings, one at a time, and bam, and I'm organizing. And I was moving around from here to here in all my little spots. And I rushed out the door, and I didn't get back until late in the evening, actually. In the meantime, Jane had come home and had picked up the mail and put it in this area, which meant she was on that spot. Very important, this spot's coming up now. So she was on the spot. Now, don't forget, I had forgotten about my brother, and I've been troubled about it. You know, I like knowing that there's something greater than a human power that I can go to for answers. I mean, not that I don't trust you all, but, you know, I just sometimes think that, you know, there's got to be more than just us. So, and I like that connection. And the longer I'm sober and the more I search for this God, the more I feel it. And, it was really trouble that I didn't feel my brother Aiden anymore. So I'm back now from the meeting, and I walked into the room and was about to put the briefcase back down and on the table by my spot. And I saw the mail there. I had to put the briefcase beside it. And I looked down on the floor, and Jane was already home, and I said, Jane, there's a green marble on the floor. A bright green marble. Now, the maid was there the day before. I had been on the spot in the morning. Jane had been on the spot in the afternoon. This spot had no marble on it. Why would a green marble mean anything to me? Because my brother and I collected marbles together. And I have a candy dish full of green marbles with a lid on it. The maid couldn't have gotten one out that's in the china cabinet. And I had moved a couple little marbles up on a little picture wall we had. But they couldn't have rolled because the carpet's there. And besides, I was standing there. And she was standing there. And you know, I picked up the marble and I started to cry because I knew that miracles can become physical. How did the green marble get out of the candy dish? Even if the maid had dropped all the marbles all over the house, they would have had to go through walls, and maybe that occurred. Maybe one bounced really high. But it wasn't there on the spot. When I went out in the morning, or when she came home in the afternoon, and I came home, and there was the marble. It meant everything to me. I knew my brother was okay. I felt it again. I got strong again. My faith was restored. I don't know how I got off on that. However, that's now what my life is about. That's what it's about now for me. A green marble meant everything. Would trade years of success for that moment of picking up, wow, what do you think this is? It's a green marble. That's how it is. When my brother, my uncle Packy, Patrick, another Patrick, passed away on the way to Tulsa, this morning I was in Charles' bathroom and I said, you know, Packy, never left Ireland. Welcome to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Purple trees, you know, tulips, flat as a pancake. Very different than Ireland. Welcome to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, how did I become this kind of person? How did I become the kind of person that has spent 3 months, night and day, day and night, being of service to my neighbors? I even like some of them. Many people haven't even a nodding acquaintance with humility as a way of life. The theory seems to be that once everybody's primary instincts are satisfied, there won't be much left to quarrel about. There used to be that theory, you know, in 1948, that everything would be perfect in the world. The world would turn happy and be free to concentrate on culture and character. Solely by their own intelligence and labor, men will have shaped their own destiny. We all know that that's outside. Nothing happens on the outside that isn't now spiritually created on the inside in my mind. For thousands of years, we have demanded more than our share of security, prestige, social instinct, and romance, sexual instinct. We seem to be succeeding. We drank to dream still greater dreams. When we were frustrated, even in part, we drank for oblivion. Never was there enough of what we thought we wanted. That has happened to me sober. In all of these strivings, so many of them well-intentioned, our crippling handicap was our lack of humility. We had lacked the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values had to come first, that the material satisfactions were not the purpose of living. Instead of regarding the satisfaction of our material desires as the means by which we could live and function as human beings, we had taken these satisfactions to be the final end and aim of life. All I wanted from those satisfactions was to be safe. All I wanted from those satisfactions was for them to dull the fears inside of me. I used that drive to not have my fears overwhelm me. They did anyway, because I never constructed a foundation inside. instead of regarding the gate. True, most of us thought good character was desirable, but obviously good character was something one needed to get on with the business of being self-satisfied. With a proper display of honesty and morality, we'd stand a better chance of getting what we really wanted. But whenever we had to choose between character and comfort, the character building was lost in the dust, the old idea, of our chase, lost in the dust of our chase after what we thought was happiness. So the inside job is a new idea, the outside seeking is an old idea. Seldom do we look at character building as something desirable in itself, something we would like to strive for, whether our instinctual needs were met or not. We never thought of making honesty, tolerance, and true love of man and God the daily basis of living. Interesting that he put man first. How do I really love my God if I don't love you? If I'm not willing to accept you. The lack of anchorage to any permanent values, this blindness to the true purpose of our life, produced another bad result. For just as long as we were convinced that we could live exclusively by our own individual strength and intelligence, for just that long was the working faith in a higher power impossible. As long as we placed self-reliance first, a genuine reliance upon a higher power was out of the question. The basic ingredient of humility, a desire to seek and do God's will, was missing. So in step 6, where it tells us to cooperate, that's the result of cooperation, is that you get to use your will as a desire to seek and do God's will. We talked about that earlier. Alcoholics Anonymous is told and soon realizes for himself, the gentleman, that his humble admission of powerlessness, acceptance over alcohol, or acceptance over your sober life today, is the first step toward liberation from its paralyzing grip. So it is that we see humility as a necessity. All the other things are wants. You're here because you want to be sober. You're here because you want a spiritual search. You're here because you want this to be true. You're here because you really want to believe me. You hope I'm telling the truth. You're here because you want that hope bigger and bigger and bigger. That's all I want. Humility is a need. But this is the barest beginning. To get completely away from our aversion to the idea of being humble, the old idea of being humble, to gain a vision of humility as an avenue to true freedom of the human spirit, that's the new idea, to be willing to work for humility as something to be desired for yourself takes most of us a long, long time. A whole lifetime geared to self-centeredness cannot be set in reverse all at once. We start this process in the second step by coming to believe. The beginning. And they have a number of questions on here that are really worth reading, you know. They talk about all of these flaws, which is in the big book on page 73, that you have to deal with so that you can prevent a retreat into alcoholism once more, a retreat into darkness, a retreat into depression, a retreat into humanness, which would be to put comfort first, then spirituality, which is character second, a retreat into self-reliance versus cooperation with God's will, or a retreat into blame as opposed to responsibility, a retreat into judgment and worry as opposed to acceptance, or a retreat into forgetting God as opposed to remembering God. A retreat into a spiritual deficiency as opposed to enlarging your spiritual life. I mean, there are lots of places and things you can retreat into sober. At this stage of our progress, we are under heavy pressure and coercion to do the right thing. We're obliged to choose between the pains of trying and certain penalties of failing to do so. You know, they're talking really about this heavy pressure and coercion to do the right thing when you hit that sober bottom and you need to change. And don't forget, anytime you want to trigger a change, my experience, anytime, when I forget everything, if I can say the Serenity Prayer, it automatically slams the doors open for me. And all those little slogans on the walls when we first got sober, take it easy, first things first, but for the grace of God, all the rest of them, think, and, you know, all of them, for me, and they all used to really protect me when I first got sober, and I'd see the little bumper stickers, and I'd say, oh my God, that's great, and you know, and they all still work now, but what works for me the most is the Serenity Prayer. In fact, I don't say the Lord's Prayer at meetings anymore. Not out of lack of respect or tradition, because that's all it is a tradition. But I've had the opportunity to travel the world, and there's a lot of people that are not just Christian. and I just can't do it anymore. I can't do it anymore. AA is not affiliated with any sect, denomination. I can't do it anymore. So I say the Serenity Prayer silently while everyone else says the Lord Prayer, and I like the sound of it. But it's too limiting for me. I can't limit myself. Serenity Prayer is so broad, everybody can understand the Serenity Prayer. I also don't participate in signing court cards. This is just my own personal thing. In meetings anymore. We're not affiliated with the courts and the judges. Before you know it, suddenly they're going to be telling, I just don't think it's proper. It's nice. It's a tradition. It's respected. I don't do it. And, you know, it's great for me to be an individual in Alcoholics Anonymous who understands these things about herself. I also don't believe that medication is just because you're having a bad day. I think it's because you absolutely need it. You've gone to great lengths with people in AA, too, to advise you that you must take it. I also don't drink, near beer, or duels. Anything that they require you to be over 21 to drink must have some alcohol in it, wouldn't you think? But when we have taken a square look at some of these defects, step 4, have discussed them with another, step 5, and have become willing to have them removed, step 6, our thinking about humility commences to have a wider meaning. By this time, in all probability, we have gained some measure of release from our most devastating handicaps. Thus, the substitution that we talked about before comes in. We enjoy moments in which there is something like real peace of mind, which is unconditional spiritual love and acceptance without judgment. To those of us who had hitherto known only excitement, depression, or anxiety, in other words, to all of us, this newfound peace is a priceless gift. It's inside. Something new indeed has been added. Where humility had formerly stood for a force feeding on humble pie, it now begins to mean the nourishing ingredient which will give us serenity. Of course, we'll fully explain the benefits of that in 11 and 12 tomorrow. The improved perception of humility. The improved perception of humility. What is perception? A miracle. The improved perception of the miracle, to see the miracle for what it really is, how big this miracle is, and that you are in the miracle. You are your own miracle. You're in the miracle of your own life. It's amazing. The improved perception of humility starts another revolutionary change in our outlook. Bigger, bigger, bigger. Be careful with miracles. Be careful with being grateful. Be careful with saying thank you. You say thank you for every little miracle, you get to say thank you to a bigger miracle. And then you're saying thank you to an even bigger miracle. And before you realize it, you're saying thank you all the time. And the miracles are constant. You see one miracle, it's like leprechauns. You never see one? Hey, you're lost. You see one, you see another one, another one, another one, another one. And you know there's a pot of gold because you're seeing leprechauns. That's it. This is how it is with miracles. They are everywhere. Be careful. You start seeing them and you want them and you expect them and you feel better when you know you're having one. Our eyes begin to open. The immense values just come straight out of painful, eager puncturing, which, by the way, is offset with self-acceptance. You know, I had somebody recently say to me, I wrote my inventory and I read it to my sponsor and I could kill myself. I said, really? Oh, yes, but pain is gain. I said, where the hell did you read that? Well, it's in the book. And then sure enough, you know, they found it. I said, but you didn't read on. You did not read on. Because it says, everywhere we saw failure and misery transformed by humility into priceless assets. We heard story after story of how humility had brought strength out of weakness. In every case, pain had been the price of admission into a new life. I thought, oh, yeah, there it is. But this admission price had purchased more than we expected. It brought a measure of humility, which we soon discovered to be the healer of pain. Just 3 lines later. That doesn't mean you should be killing yourself between inventories. It means you probably haven't accepted yourself for what you've written. We began to fear pain less and desired humility more than ever. Then, it said, we saw we needn't always be bludgeoned and beaten into humility. I said, now, did you read that part? It could come quite as much from our voluntarily reaching for it as it could from unremitting suffering. It is understandable at the beginning of your sobriety that you don't know that. After all, you're still used to surviving. Not living, just surviving. no surprise that you would think that you'd have to be bloodied on the wall. And if you were anything like me, I had to run into the wall and be bloodied 1,000 times before I was willing to change. So yes, I thought, no pain, no gain. Thank God I got over that and realized that as soon as I have that pain, I can voluntarily, instantly, immediately reach for that third step, make the decision to get through that process, and it can be that fast, and it will vanish. Voluntarily, reach a point. A great turning point in our lives came. We sought for humility as something we really wanted, rather than something we must have. We need it. There's a difference between you need it, and you want it, and you must have it. There's a lot of things I must have. I got them. Didn't do anything for me. I got them. Why don't I feel different? As we approach the actual taking of step 7, it might be well if we AAs inquire once more just what our deeper objectives are. I forgot that in the 5th month, the other thing that we do is we write a list of our assets. To be in balance, it's good to know your liabilities, but it's also very important to know your assets. Wonderful. Hard thing to do, by the way, is to write a list of your assets. Fabulous experience. And the reason that is important is because now that we're on the 7th step, it says, inquire once more just what our deeper objectives are. I mean, if you don't know your assets, you don't want to know necessarily what you want more of. You know what you want less of, but wouldn't it be nice to know what you would like more of? Each of us would like to live at peace with himself and with his fellows. We would like to be assured that the grace of God can do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. You know, I said to Jane this morning, would you mind doing me a favor? I'm looking up the word grace while I was rushing through this thing. And grace in the dictionary says, and there's probably all kinds of dictionaries with different things, but this particular dictionary, pleasing quality, beauty of charm, of form, composition, movement, or expression, 12th step. A sense of what is right and proper, balance, 2nd step. Thoughtfulness toward others and goodwill, 8th and 9th step. A short prayer in which blessing is asked or thanks is given, as in a meal, nourishment, 6th and 7th step. Unmerited love and favor of God toward man, 7 and 11. Divine influence acting in man to make him pure and morally strong, 11. A special virtue given to a person by God to bring honor to something. Don't know what the hell that word is. Oh, to bring honor and dignity. That's a description to me of a miracle. That would be like the 12th step. That's what I read this morning out of a simple little 5-letter word. We would like to be assured that the grace of God can do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. That's a lot of stuff to get out of 5 little letters. We have seen that character defects based upon short-sighted or unworthy desires are the obstacles that block our path toward these objectives, those instincts out of balance again. We can now clearly see that we have been making unreasonable demands upon ourselves, upon God, and upon others. The chief activator of our defects has been self-centered fear. It took 76 pages plus an entire big book for Bill to finally get there. And thank God it took so long and in such a slow process that fear is the bottom of every single solitary thing that affects our life. Primarily fear that we will lose something we already possessed or would fail to get something we demanded. Living upon a basis of unsatisfied demands, we were in a state of continual disturbance and frustration. If you ever wondered what unmanageability is, I mean, that's a nice description. Therefore, no peace was to be had unless we could find a means of reducing these demands. It didn't say take them away. It just said reduce them. The difference between a demand and a simple request is plain to anyone. The 7th step is where we make changes in our attitude, which permit us, with humility as our guide, to move out from ourselves
toward others, 8 and 9, and towards God, 11 and 12. The whole emphasis of step 7 is on humility. It is really saying to us that we now ought to be willing to try humility in seeking the removal of our other shortcomings. Just as we did when we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, step 1, and came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, step 2. If that degree of humility could enable us to find the grace by which such a deadly obsession could be banished, then there must be hope of the same result respecting any other problem we could possibly have. This must be the third or so time that they have said, this is about living. This is about living a sober, full life. Use the steps for all of your other problems. It will work as effectively as it has with the biggest problem of your life. It's an enormous spiritual promise to end the today with. Enormous spiritual problem. That you'll never be alone again. That you've now got the path to amend all of your spiritual thinking. That you can change everything that you've ever thought. That everything you thought might be an old idea is just ready to be put into the shoes. Get into the same shoes of the old idea and convert it to a new idea. Polish the shoes. I mean, I love the 7 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love them. I decided to end on 7 so that we would have the opportunity to then work on the portion where we go towards God and towards our fellows, 8 and 9 and our fellows, and 11 and 12 for God. Because step 1 through 7 is all about us. It's all about me, my individual process that takes me to the point where I now know enough about myself that I can actually entertain the possibility of having a relationship with my fellow man and a greater relationship with this God that I am on the way to discovering even more about. I mean, we've just done in the last few hours all these steps. I'm going to be doing them forever. I'm looking forward to tomorrow because as I do them, I find out more, as I read about them, even here today, find out more that I just want to do. I no longer have the overwhelming, bleeding desire to go out and do all these things right. I just have a desire to, like, want to do these things. There's so much. There is so, so, so much. It's extraordinary. So now, we're very much on time here, which in itself is amazing. And if you have any questions or anything about these 7 steps, I would be happy to entertain that. If you are curious about an old idea and you want to transpose it to a new idea, we could talk about that. How do you know what your old idea is? What are you sitting there and what is the thing that's most paramount on your mind that you cannot handle today? It's just a matter of changing it to a new idea. If you have no questions, you can think about it. We'll have much more time tomorrow for questions and answers after the whole thing is over. Yes.
I have an old idea about honesty coming through.
You have an old idea? What is it?
In the moment, whatever that is, I seem to tell the truth. But then when I look back at it, it may not be true.
Right. And if you did tell the truth, you'd probably be worried about what they say. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it all comes down to judgment and worry, that your fear is you're going to be judged. If you do tell the truth, they're going to do somebody's going to do something to you. I had that one, by the way. I knew that while I was reasonably honest, that I really wasn't honest. Like I could be looking in your eyes and lying to you. And it just seemed easier to lie. You know, I justified it by saying, oh, why don't I need to get into all that anyway? But the truth is I was left with this like little feeling of unfinished stuff, like a little dishonest mess in there that needed to clean up. And I then went back and I thought about it for a long time because I knew that it was a fear. And I had also had to take a look at how I had used honesty sometimes to hurt other people because, you know, everything is, I mean, in the most subtle ways. And then I found a portion in the Big Book where it said, you know, basically the way I understood it, because this is what the great thing about the Big Book and the 12 and 12 is that when you read it, you understand it, what you hear, what you see. You know, I've actually spoken, people have come up and said, gee, I really appreciate what you said about such and such. And then what did I say? And they tell me, I never said that. That's a lot. Same thing with you read. So it allows for you. So my interpretation of that was that, for instance, I then realized that I had to be more honest with people. I mean, I'd rather tell you that, I had to go to the Great Wall of China or something rather than say I didn't want to visit your house. 15 people died and, I'm late because I left the house late. No, I'm late because there was a massive wreck on the 405. And, I mean, really, I was like that. I couldn't tell you the truth. My life depended on it when I got sober for a long time. Really, long time. I mean, big. And then it just got too uncomfortable. Too uncomfortable. And I had to decide, when could I not tell the truth so that I would know when it was okay to tell the truth? Because, I found out an AA from a spiritual person. I didn't have any boundaries, really. I just kind of like made my own. And then, when you're drinking, they change all the time depending on your needs. So I had to decide, when could I not tell the truth? Was there a time that I could ever not tell the truth? And there is. I could not tell the truth when it meant that I was going to harm somebody else in any way, shape, or form. And that became the basis within which I learned how to tell the truth, to what I could tell. And then in the last few years, I'm still not very good at it, I lie by omission. I didn't lie at all. I just don't tell you. Now I say, I'm just late. Still inconsiderate that I'm, did that to you, but so what? If you press, we'll go on further. So what I do now is I say, I am powerless over my ability to tell the truth. And it makes me feel unmanageable when I don't. And I hate that feeling. It's just a little feeling. And I have to come to believe by practicing the telling the truth within my parameter now, when I can and I cannot, that I will be restored to sanity. Which means that if I practice enough times, I'll tell the truth more times than not. We left off yesterday with the seventh step. And someone gave me this at one time. It was in the office of Dr. Bob, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. This plaque was in the office of Dr. Bob, the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the title of the plaque that was on his desk was Humility. Will be left off. And it said, perpetual quietness of heart, it is to have no trouble, it is never to be fretted or vexed, irritable or sore, to wonder at nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to rest when nobody praises me, and when I am blamed or despised, it is to have an honest, blessed home in myself where I can go and shut the door and pray to my Father in secret and be at peace, as in the deep sea of calmness when all around and about is seemingly trouble. I've always liked that because, in real life, that's what the steps do. That's real life. I mean, is there one person in the room today, I'd like to meet them anyway, that doesn't have some troubling little aspect in their own life or in their children's life or their somebody, somewhere, a friend that you just wish you could change? Just a little thing you wish would be different. You can't do anything about it. And yet, inside, you have this little moment of peace. I mean, the mere fact that we can even be aware that we have a moment of peace is an extraordinary experience of humility, isn't it? So, step 8. In step 4 we find out what we were afraid of. In step 8 I think you find out who you're afraid of. Just like in step 5 you find out where you're going, where you've been, and step 11 will tell you where you're going. The rest of the steps will tell you how to get there. And also step 8 and 9, I see them really as kind of one giant, like an accordion step. Somewhat together, because eight gets you current and 9, leads you to 10 where you need to be current. So, you've now gotten current with yourself, with this God, and it's time to get current with the people. And that is really the most difficult thing of all, isn't it? So I also found that for myself, you know, people have lots of words and then they all work that I've heard over the years that are associated with the steps, you know, the first step of honesty and the second one of hope and the third step representing faith and the fourth step courage, the fifth step I think is integrity, sixth step willingness, of course, and the seventh step humility. The eighth, you see, when I don't like what I hear, I just change it and it goes right out of my mind. But it was something I didn't think was appropriate, so I can't even tell you what it was. I changed it to compassion for myself. Because for me, I needed to feel compassion for other human beings. I didn't know what that felt like. I had heard about compassion, I read definitions of compassion, but I didn't have any feeling about compassion. And didn't know about it until the practice, many times, of 8 and 9. And I found that I had a lack of sense, a lack of balance of what justice meant to me. You know, the scales of justice out there. And I didn't have that kind of balance. I mean, I either loved you or hated you. And it could swing. And so I don't know what the usual wording is for 8 and 9 because I've come so used to identifying it myself. Personally, my experience has been that I have felt passion. And I have felt the sense of justice with the world, which is extraordinary for somebody like me to think that I could even have a sense of justice and be part of that and play a role in it. 10, of course, is the step of perseverance. I mean, that is obviously what that is. 11 is spirituality and 12 of service. So here in 8, for me, it opened up my heart and my sense of compassion, and I have had experience with compassion ever since. And the more experience I had with compassion, the less judgment I have. And the more acceptance. And it talks about right away, not necessarily, of course, you know, all the steps, you don't do them, eventually you might drink, but by the time, when you're sober, it's really about how to deal with your life today. In steps 8 and 9, it says here, steps 8 and 9 are concerned with personal relations. You know, I used to think for many years that it was concerned with amends. So you make 1,000 amends, and yet I did not truly develop any compassion over those personal, I didn't finish the job. Well, I may have made the amends, God knows, you know, you do a really good job, particularly at the beginning when you're willing to do anything. It's later on that you start to rationalize that you don't need to make those amends at all. In fact, they need to make them to you. But even after all my willingness in 8 and 9 to make the amends, I never followed up. I cleaned up my side of the street. I hoped they would clean up their side of the street. And that's where I left off. You know, I didn't really understand personal relations. I didn't understand that it was none of my business what was on their side of the street, and that I was powerless over that, and that I had to accept that, and that I had to see beyond that. And you know, it's like looking with new eyes, you know, through this integration. If you just do the steps enough times, it's this integration with your higher self, and you start to see through different eyes. I mean, to be able to see the same person a couple of years ago that I just thought was a very terrible person. And then just because I had softened and became less afraid and more able to listen and really look at somebody while I was listening to them, I began to see that human being as a person. You know, I've kind of forgot what it was that even annoyed me about them so much after a while. It's really a tremendous transition. It says, first, we look backward and try to discover where we had been at fault. Step 4. Next, we make a vigorous attempt to repair the damage we have done. We get advice on how to do that in step 5. And third, having thus cleaned away the debris of the past, 6 and 7, we consider how our newfound knowledge of ourselves, we can develop the best possible relations with every other human being, step 8. So now it is no surprise to me years later that 8 and 9 follow 1 through 7. I think at the beginning, the greatest thing I ever did is run out, accept the first half of the first step, figure the unmanageability just came with life, never imagined it would be any different really. Jumped around to the fourth step because you have no choice. They made us do it at the beginning. That's how it was. It just made you do it. There was no like when you get well and your therapist says it's okay and you're fully medicated. It was immediately raw, upfront, do it now. We don't care where you're at. You're as sick as your secrets. Write it out. And the second you wrote it out, if you had a really kind of with its sponsor, they kind of made a list of anybody's name that you happen to throw out along the way. And then you had to just immediately grab this amend list and go and do those things. find the people, do whatever you had to do, try not to get yourself thrown in jail in the interim, killed or otherwise, and then run out and help every alcoholic you can possibly find on the street, drunk or otherwise, drag them to a meeting. Now, that was how we stayed sober, and that's how I stayed sober for a long time. And then I had this newfound knowledge of myself begin to be revealed from listening to other people, and it was then when I found that when I found out about myself was when I really developed this compassion for other people. I had some emotion toward other people before, but I didn't have any compassion. I had to have it for myself first. So this thing that we talked about yesterday about receiving, when I received and accepted myself and had this compassion and caring and love for myself, that then made me understand how huge and how big this love I was receiving constantly from the second I hit this earth, that I had turned my back on it, but it had never stopped. The light, the ray, the power, the force, whatever you call it, had truly never, ever stopped until I turned my back. And when I found out in the seventh step how huge that was and how big that was, why I became much less afraid, and by being much less afraid, I was able to then begin to amend my attitude and my relations with other people in a whole new way. So again, I think that the 12 and 12 may be for people with a couple of years who are ready now to take this deeper search, because it requires you to look at your own self way before you go out and decide to address anything with anybody else, so that you're bringing something to give them in exchange. It's one thing to make an amend. I mean, Duke used to say at the beginning, if you're going to make an amend, don't go without your checkbook. If you don't have your checkbook ready, don't go. Just conversation. But you know, now when I go to make an amend to somebody, you know, I have to bring them a gift. I don't necessarily owe them money, but I'm going to give them something. I want to give them something. And the only thing I can give them is my absolute willingness to accept whatever it is that they say back, and my willingness to love them and to be truly, to feel that. And they'll know it. And it doesn't require one single word. So this is a very large order. It is a task which we may perform with increasing skill, but never really finish. I mean, I love these people that say, listen, I did the steps, now it's all about action. Go out there and work with the other alcoholic. And I don't read that at all. It is a task which we may perform with increasing skill, but never really finish. Learning how to live in the greatest peace, partnership, and brotherhood with all men and women of whatever description is a moving and fascinating adventure. And then they go on to describe things that we do and the survey, the things that we have to look at as we look at this inventory of our relations with people. A survey of the human wreckage, the list of people that we hurt. So the great advantage of doing this will quickly reveal themselves that the pain will be lessened as one obstacle after another melts away. These obstacles, however, are very real. The first and one of the most difficult has to do with forgiveness. I suppose the greatest thing I ever had to forgive most people for, and still comes up very regularly in my life, was the expectations that I put on them. I mean, really. I mean, I've had a thousand things to forgive people for that were, you know, the mundane, practical existence of living. I hurt you, you hurt me. But really, even today, I put expectations on people they don't even know about. My friend Cubby Salby in Los Angeles says that giving up the pain of resentment, he said, he had given up the pain of resentment for the pleasure of judgment. To escape looking at the wrongs we have done another, we resentfully focus on the wrongs he has done us. This is especially true if he has in fact behaved badly at all. Triumphantly, we seize upon his misbehavior as the perfect excuse for minimizing or forgetting our own. And then it tells us that alcoholics are not the only ones bedeviled by sick emotions. You know, to be bedeviled is another way of putting that into current day language would be to be obsessed. Moreover, it is usually a fact that our behavior when drinking has aggravated the defects of others. We repeatedly strained the practice of our best friends to the snapping point, brought up the very worst. In many instances, we are really dealing with fellow sufferers, people whose woes we have increased. If we are now about to ask forgiveness for ourselves, why shouldn't we start out forgiving them one and all? Now, you know, we talked about this forgiveness in the sixth step. The forgiveness of oneself is the acceptance of yourself. The minute you accept yourself, you have forgiven yourself. You can't forgive yourself if you haven't accepted yourself. You accept yourself, you immediately forgive yourself. It's just automatic. And then the acceptance of that forgiveness of yourself and that acceptance lead immediately to step seven, where you have said, come now with all of your strength and all of your power, because I've made myself entirely ready. I've made myself entirely ready. By not accepting yourself, you're not judging yourself. You don't have any little smudges in this path, you know, of light. So if you could imagine a path of life, light, and you wanted it completely directed toward you, well, if you have a little judgment in there, a little lack of acceptance, a little out of balance, well, you have a smudge there. Could you imagine if you just clean up those little smudges for a second? How powerful that light is going to be. Forgiving people, I have had great difficulty with it. You know, Duke told me at the very beginning how it worked, and I tried all the millions of things you read about and do to change all that, but it really gets down to the simple thing that he told me 28 and a half years ago. He said, well, I don't know what you're going to do. He said, they're not going to change, and chances are you're not ready to change right now yourself either, so we're going to have to do the only thing we know to do. So you're going to go home every night, going to get down on your knees and pray for them for 14 nights in a row. Oh, please. So I did. And I would qualify the prayer by saying, I don't even want to do this. But if he asks me tomorrow, I want to say that I did it. Because the hassle from him was much worse than not doing that. And you know, by the 14th night, something had melted inside of me. And I was actually able to have an exchange and have the beginning of what I have come to find out is a personal relationship with somebody. The ability to talk to someone back and forth and have an exchange. And actually wait for their answer before I think of what I want to say next. And then they go on for quite a way with lots of questions and conversation about how we never, you know, are the cry of the sober alcoholic. You know, we've never hurt anybody but ourselves. You know, when you know, I love it in AA when you have this big thing about how everybody did everything to you, and then you find out, oh, hell, that doesn't work anymore. Nobody believes that. And then you turn it on yourself. The best of the inventory is that I turned on myself. You know, how to really abuse yourself is to take your own information and then whip yourself with it. You don't even have to have anybody else do it. And it's very, very common. I mean, it's very, very common. It's also the biggest lie of all. You know, I would rather than have you tell me how terrific I am, and I don't need to do that to myself, when in fact the day will come when 3 o'clock in the morning you'll have to tell yourself how terrific you are, and you have to learn how to do that in the middle of the night. There'll be nobody else there but you and God. But it says that this attitude, of course, is the end result of purposeful forgetting. I love that. Purposeful forgetting is an attitude which can only be changed by a deep and honest search of our motives and actions. A really exhaustive survey of our past life, it says. A really exhaustive survey of our past life. You know, for many years I did the typical inventory about who the people were, and I do that today. You know, in the month of August, when I do an inventory, I flash right down, and anybody that comes into my mind that I feel a little hesitation with, and if I don't even know why, I don't even think about these things, just a little hesitation. If their face comes in front of me, or some little thought of their name comes in front of me, I jot it down, because that is a person that I am using, they don't even know it, to block the light. That's what I am doing to block the light. Now you would think, why would you even want to block the light? Because that is the nature of us, to block that light. Don't forget, those fears are still in there saying, do not do this to me, Dracula and the light from the sun. A couple of years ago, I read this and I thought, well, this is really an exhaustive survey from our past life. I wonder if I could do something with that just for fun. So in the month of August and September, I think it was last year or the year before, I'm not really sure, what we decided to do in our little step group was the basis in the nature of who I am, good and bad, comes from the structure of my family, from my heritage, from those that I know. And so we took a piece of paper, put a few columns on it. And on one side it said paternal, and the other side, maternal. And I wrote down paternal grandfather, paternal grandmother, paternal grandfather, what's next? Oh, yeah, yeah. Paternity. They're on each side. Doubles. Double grandmother and then my grandfather. Maternal grandfather, maternal grandmother, and then my mother. I also had a column for other on each side because some of us were not necessarily raised all the time by our existing parent or grandparent. And I had a lady that can't say worked because it's just wrong, was a truly loved member of the family who helped raise me for a period of my life and probably had more influence on the loving, nurturing part of who I am than maybe anybody else. So that column was for her. And it was really interesting because under each section, we made one of those T things, you know, where you have assets and liabilities. And then very quickly, without any major analysis whatsoever, just a quick, spontaneous reaction, under each person, what I felt they were like. What was the characters of my grandmother, my paternal grandmother? Maybe some of the negative ones would have been extraordinarily selfish and blah, 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 blah. And what were the assets? Well, she was extremely responsible, brilliant, intelligent, responsible woman. Well, you know, what were the assets on the other side? Nurturing, warm, comforting, demanding, whatever. It means to have a whole other headset to do that kind of thing. But if you know what I mean, and the minute you think about that parent and that grandparent, I also never knew my maternal grandfather, but I knew enough things about him that people had said, and it is all perception. Life is perception. That's why we can have miracles in here, and so readily have more and more and more, because it's what you perceive. So life is perception, and it was what I perceived that person was like that influenced me. And my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, in this case, I saw very, very little of him, but the little bit I saw of him had a great influence on me. And it was marvelous at the end of the time when we discussed this in our group. Because we went down, listed all these words, you know, that you look up, selfish, selfish. And you can be greedy. You know, actually, I took the seven deadly sins and made it easy for myself. And I put greed, lust, pride, envy. And what do they have of that? And then I took assets that people would have, kind, nurturing, caring, compassionate. And I listed those things so that I could stay within the framework of what I'm used to using. I try to use the same words all the time in my inventories. I use the seven deadly sins and selfish, self-seeking, inconsiderate, and dishonest all the time so that I don't get off track and, you know, create more confusion for myself. And I actually now recall that that's what I ended up doing, taking the seven, this is my experience, taking the seven deadly sins and just listing which of those apply to the person, and then some assets. And I thought, well, now that's very interesting, you know, because really that's what I thought those people were. And then in the ninth month, the next month, when I really looked at it again, I thought, what would happen if I circled all the words that were the same for each of them? How many of them were selfish? How many of them were greedy? How many of them had a lot, gluttony? How many of them? And how many of the assets were the same? And it was very interesting. It was very interesting. And about three or four defects and about three or four assets seemed to rise right to the top as being very consistent. And I took a look at them and I couldn't believe what I saw. Because what I saw was me. It was so interesting and so much fun to share with the group and have them talk about their family history. It's a wonderful thing. I walked on the beach with someone and they told me all about their family and their mother and their father, and I listened and listened. You know, it's fun to listen to other people's stories, like watching television or something. And then I realized how beneficial it is to just go for a walk with somebody and say, you know, this Tuesday I'll talk about my family, and next Tuesday, you talk about your family. That's how I've come to find out who I am. Very interesting to me. It says, in many instances, we find that though the harm done others has not been great, the emotional harm we have done ourselves has. Otherwise, we wouldn't change at all. If we weren't left with the residual of that, we would never change. Very deep, sometimes quite forgotten, damaging emotional conflicts persist below the level of consciousness. That's why when I did that family inventory, I learned about perception and how I had perceived things, and that way back there, I still believe some of those very old ideas. At the time of these occurrences, they may actually have given our emotions violent twists, which have since discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worst. No question. While the purpose of making one restitution to others is paramount, two, it is equally necessary that we extricate from an examination of our personal relations every bit of information about ourselves and our fundamental difficulties that we can.
You know, it took me a long time before I saw in this step, the eighth step, I was so busy about you and making amends to you that I didn't really read that it was all about what does it mean to me? What has it left me with? What do I have to do? How do I address it from my own point of view? What are my fundamental different difficulties? What harm have I done to myself? I used to think that was a very selfish kind of way to look at things until I realized that until I can stand in my own light, then you are not safe with me. And the greatest gift I can give you is to have some balance and knowledge and understanding of myself. That's the greatest gift I can give you. You will be the safest you will ever be with me when I stand beside my God. You are at risk when I am by myself. Since defective relations with other human beings have nearly always been the immediate cause of our woes, including our alcoholism, no field of investigation could yield more satisfying and valuable rewards than this one. Calm, thoughtful reflection upon personal relations can deepen our insight. We can go far beyond those things which were superficially wrong with us to see those flaws which were basic flaws which sometimes were responsible for the whole pattern of our lives. Thoroughness we have found will pay. I mean, that is such a huge statement because the pattern of our lives includes people that we love, marry, associate with, become friends with. That is the pattern of our lives. It affects a lot of people. To define, and then they go on to talk about harm. It's very important to know what the word harm means if you have any intention of having personal relationships with anybody and you intend to make an amend so that you don't harm them. To define the word harm in a practical way, we might call it the result of instincts in collision. You know, those old instincts from yesterday. Social instincts, security instincts, and sexual instincts. You know, I can't help but always see little shamrocks when I see those three things. And social, security, instincts, a little shamrock. And another little shamrock of physical and emotional and spiritual. And then the great shamrock of God, ourselves, and other people. And AA and meetings and God. I mean, you can't pluck one of those little leaves off. It just won't work. All those, so many things, probably starting with the Trinity, came in these threes. And I like this too, where it says that these instincts in collision that we talked about at length yesterday, which cause physical, mental, and emotional or spiritual damage. I never really knew until a few years ago that I could cause spiritual damage to somebody. You know, mess up their life enough so that they go absolutely mad. They cut their own light off. I just caused them spiritual damage. So what's the greatest gift you can give somebody? The opportunity not to cut off their own light. And not only that, to double the energy by sharing with your light. If we lie or cheat, talked about lying yesterday, we deprive others not only of their worldly goods, but of their emotional security and peace of mind. Oh, that's a huge thing they just said here. Made me a lot more respectful of people's time, people's money, people's energy. Made me nicer. And then it talks about what will happen to you if you continue to do that and don't think about the other people. You'll be irritable, critical, impatient, humorless, dominating, wallow in depression. I mean, you know, really nice things. And this is having carefully surveyed this whole area of human relations and having decided exactly what personality traits in us injured and disturbed others, we can now commence to ransack memory for the people to whom we have given offense. Then, as year by year, we walk back through our lives. It was so wonderful when I started to do the eighth step and walk back through my life from today, as opposed to the first way I used to do it, which was from the beginning when I was born, forward. Now I go from here, because this is where I live. In this 24 hours, there is no more world for me. And then I look back, and I go back, as from today. It was really a wonderful word. Back through our lives as far as memory will reach. I also decided that if my memory didn't immediately get there, I was not going to struggle and force it to go. It sure makes inventory and the process of self-examination, which is powerful. Self-examination, prayer, and meditation is the whole secret to peace, but it just made it easier not to struggle. If I can't remember something, it's not bothering me. I may remember it tomorrow. Fine, I'll add it. That's why I don't use any guides or 67 pages of this guy's guide and that book and I just stand still and or sit still and see what's on my mind and jot it down. Then as year by year we walk back through our lives, as far as memory will reach, we shall be bound to construct a long list of people who have, or to some extent or another, been affected. We shall want to hold ourselves to the course of admitting the things we have done, meanwhile forgiving the wrongs done us, real or fancied. We talked yesterday about real or imagined. Same thing. You know, they used to say when I first got sober that you should give up, clean up, make up, and grow up. We should avoid extreme judgments, both of ourselves and others involved, and we must not exaggerate our defects or theirs. I mean, have you ever gone to make an amend, and you're talking about the defect of character that you have, and you get so carried away that you, like, make it out to be 10 times worse than the event that even happened, because you just feel good about yourself and your ability to, like, communicate. Then you have to go back and make an amend and say, half that crap didn't even happen. It is the beginning of the end of isolation from our fellows and from God. You know, what I ended up doing over the years is learning how to amend my hows, you know. How did I hurt or harm other people? I never, ever tell anybody anything that will harm them. It's the old saying, never give anyone information that will not serve them. It is harmful to tell anyone anything that will not serve them. If you cannot be of service with what you say, don't say anything. I had to amend my negative thinking. I had to amend my level of honesty with others. I had to look at words that I didn't even understand, like envy and jealousy and insecurity. And then there's a saying that I'd rather say no and be guilty than yes and be angry. You know. And then we go on to step 9, where we talk about boundaries for ourselves and having choices. Jane, may I borrow that book for a minute? I have to borrow an old 12 and 12, because before we get to 9, one of the few times in the book that I really went out of my way to look up words so that I would understand them, because I somewhat had to understand what they were talking about so that I could be as thorough as possible and not have my own definition of what I thought a word meant. Because in step 9 it says, made direct amends to such people wherever possible except to do so with injure them or others. And the first couple of words in this little baby paragraph were full of things I truly didn't understand. It said, good judgment, a careful sense of timing, courage, and prudence. These were the qualities we shall need when we take step 9. I thought, wow, what do they mean? So I looked up the word judgment, a mental ability to perceive and distinguish the relationship between two objects. It required me to ask questions of God so that I could help determine what the differences were. Sound, reasonable decision or evaluation, an assertion of something believed. Well, I had come to believe a lot, so I knew that I would begin to understand the word judgment. But I wasn't sure what prudence meant. I didn't know that for me it would come to mean the ability to pause. Caution, but also the capacity for judging in advance the probable results of one's actions. You know the old sign on the walls years ago, think, think, think. Prudence, wise in handling practical matters, careful in regards to one's own interests, circumspect, careful about one's conduct. Then I understood why you needed judgment and prudence before you made an amend. And courage, the state or quality of mind or spirit that enables one to face danger with self-possession, confidence, and resolution. You gotta be really prepared before you make an amend. And then it says, you know, there was also in this particular dictionary, Cursus Meum, they had referred to the word bravery under courage. And I thought, well, I'll just look it up just for the hell of it. Bravery, admirable human action in difficult circumstances. Brave, associated with an innate quality. And then I thought, what do they mean by innate quality? Possessed at birth or belonging by nature. And I fully understood the nature of my wrongs, what it meant to be restored, what it meant to pause in the 10th step, and that the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous were so huge and so powerful. And so big that they could have that much information in them in such simple words that even I could begin to apply them.